Welcome to another episode of the Telltale Heart, a Cardiovascular Digest for Pharmacists. As always, I'm Craig Beavers, the host, and excited to continue to bring cutting-edge topics to the podcast. I know 2 weeks ago, we did some work and played a game with Kyle to talk about some of the late-breaking clinical trials that were coming out at AHA. Of course, we did kind of a game where it was a drawing game where we picked three or randomly selected three and he had to talk about them. And one of them he did select is one we're going to talk about today. And then the other trial was not as one that was selected, but I still think is going to be important. And of course, we'll be talking about stuff coming out of AHA over the next several weeks with different guests and so forth. So please tune in if you're interested in getting the up-to-date science and things related to that. As always, if you have commentary or questions or want to be engaged or have ideas for contents, please email myself through my faculty page or through my social media or through the Pharmacy Times page. If you like this content, please write a review and like and subscribe on your podcast channels. That only helps us continue to know how well we're doing. We really want this to be important. And as I've been telling everyone over the next several months, too, we're going to be doing specific series related to certain disease states and maybe have some patients. I've been working on getting all those things outlined and contracted and engaged in. And so it's exciting that we'll have the opportunity to have some real patient conversations with people that I know from just my journeys. So never do, we're going to jump straight into doing this today. And I'm very excited about my guest, because we're going to talk about a couple of the trials that made a lot of buzz at the AHA meeting that came out. And again, one of them was the Vesalius trial that Kyle kind of talked about a little bit of the oversight, just on the background of what the trial design was and what it could mean. And it will get a different assessment today now that we have the data. And the other was the Coral Reef study. So they're both in the domains of the PCSK9 inhibitors and where they look. And it's very timely to have this conversation. And I have a really outstanding speaker or guest, a friend of mine, Dr. Josephine. He's the Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs and professor at the University of Colorado. I always mess up saying this campus name, Joe. How do you say the campus in Colorado? How do you say your Anschutz Medical Campus? I always get nervous when I see it. I'm like, so Joe, welcome to the podcast. So
thank you for me being here, Craig. That's a pleasure.
I love it. So, but outside of your title, Joe, and Joe and I have worked on lots of different things and have a lot of passings. Joe, tell me what makes you uniquely qualified as well to have this conversation about these various lipid studies.
Absolutely. I've followed lipids my entire career. I am initially, and deep in my heart, I'm an ambulatory care clinical pharmacist that focuses on mostly cardiovascular risk reduction. So I've managed patients with lipid disorders my entire career as a faculty member at the University of Colorado. But I've done some research focused in on lipid management, looking at everything from efficacy of different regimens to, in the real world, how well we treat patients and how poor we do at getting patients to acceptable LDL levels. I also teach lipid disorders to both pharmacy students and medical residents here at the University of Colorado. And I had the good fortune of being actively involved in the National Lipid Association. I served as a past president of the National Lipid Association. I'm still very involved with that organization as the co-director of the Foundations of Lipidology course, and also have been a guideline writing member for the 2018 AHA-ACC guidelines, and I'm currently a member of the 2026 Dyslipidemia Guideline Writing Group.
Oh no, you're going to ruin one of my questions. All right. Oh. So I can't ask you that question then. Nope. All right. No, that's good. No, it's just, I was going to ask you, not to cut to the chase, what you think the new sets of guidelines are going to foretell, and you probably can't say that. So I will flip that question back towards me and you can just sit there and smile. Okay. So we're going to jump straight into the first set of studies. So What I gather with that question is you guys in the audience, Joe really knows what he's doing with this. So the first trial is the Vesalius. It's the evolocumab in patients without a previous myocardial infarction or stroke. This trial was presented on the first day of the conference. And Joe, I just to maybe get some of your assessments. I know Kyle did a little bit of this break on. I'll go through that with you, and then I want to ask you specifically some things that I think were interesting in the trial design, or people had a lot of conversation about. And so the trial population this in this study, just so everyone is aware or reminded of, they were required to be either 50 to 79 years of age for men, or 50 to 79 years in women, and have an LDL cholesterol of at least 90 milligrams per deciliter, and a high non-density lipoprotein or non-HDL cholesterol level of at least 20 milligrams per deciliter, or an apolipoprotein B level of at least 80 milligrams per deciliter, and they should have been receiving stable, optimized lipid-lowering dose therapy for at least 2 weeks. So when you hear that, Joe, just from your perspective, what does that entail for you when you're thinking about patient population and who you're going to eventually apply this to for that piece? I know there's other eligibility criteria, and I'm going to get into that in a minute, but just from a sheer lipid panel or a lipid level standpoint, what are you thinking there?
Yeah, I'm thinking it's most of our high-risk patients. It may not be the most very high-risk patients because they were that really are your patients that have had a history of a clear event like a stroke or a myocardial infarction. But it represents a lot of other patients that we know have high risk that probably are based on just what we know in populations are not at their goal. And based on that inclusion criteria, these are people that we should lower LDL further that are already on sort of standard regimens of maximally tolerated statin therapy plus or minus ezetimibe. So they're people that we do need to treat, and we have really had traditionally not had a whole bunch of additional data for what the second or perhaps even third drug should be. And Vesalius provides insight to that.
Yeah, and absolutely. And as we'll continue on, these patients were out without a history of MI or stroke, so they haven't had an event, and met the trial criteria for at least the following for disease categories. So they had coronary artery disease, they had atherosclerotic cardiovascular or cerebrovascular disease or peripheral artery disease, or high-risk diabetes. And in this instance, they considered high-risk diabetes to be long-standing, like greater than 10 years, treated with daily insulin or complicated by microvascular disease. So they would have had to have, diabetic retinopathy or something to that effect. And they were at least to have one other criteria to place them at continue at a higher risk. So I think what you're alluding to, and I've already alluded to, is these patients are high risk. They had 65 years as well to be enriched, or active smoking, or what we kind of alluded to, very elevated lipid levels, and that concomitant disease. So it's really what you're alluding to, a high risk population. So let me ask you this question. I think this was a lot of debate, and we'll get into the results, but even at this stage, I think there's a lot of debate, or what are people defining this? And I guess the mistake I don't want people to get confused in, and how would you say this? I'm going to ask it this way, Joe. Is this a primary prevention trial, or is this a secondary prevention trial? What are you classifying this, or how are people thinking of this? Because I don't want people to misconstrue who the patient population is.
I'll tell you, that's a really good question, Craig, because I've heard people refer to this as a primary prevention trial, and that is wrong. It is not a primary prevention trial. It is not a secondary prevention trial. It's a mixed trial. That's the real truth. Because mo and you can argue more patients were secondary prevention than primary prevention in this cohort. Only a third of the patients were patients with diabetes that had no qualifying atherosclerosis. And we can debate with, because secondary prevention is really any form of atherosclerosis. It doesn't have to imply clinical ASCVD, which is symptomatic. So I think we need to wear that hat. But it's okay because we've done this before. In many ways, we went down this road with a landmark clinical trial called the Heart Protection Study, which evaluated simvastatin versus placebo. That sounds like, an old story now, but at the time when it came out, it looked at high-risk people and it included primary and secondary prevention patients. So it's fine to do that when you're powered and to assess different pockets of patients and when you design your study that way. So I think that we cannot call this a pure primary prevention study because it is not.
Very good. And we'll get into the specific patient, but I just want to make sure we distinguish that, because that is definitely a lot of conversation, or people are having that piece during the, around the time of the presentation. So, and then of course the patients were assigned in a one-to-one fashion to receive subcutaneous injections of evolocumab at a dose of 140 milligrams every 2 weeks, or matching placebo, and they were randomized and stratified according to their LDL levels and geographic regions. And the primary endpoint, efficacy endpoint of the trial was a composite. I'm going to read this to you, and I'm going to get your assessment of what that translates into, Joe. So the primary efficacy endpoint of the trial was a composite of death from coronary heart disease, myocardial infarction, or ischemic stroke, and that was a 3-point major adverse cardiac event, MACE, and a composite of death of coronary heart disease, myocardial infarction, ischemic stroke, and ischemic-driven arterial revascularization. That was a 4-point MACE. And then they define that, of course, doing any revascularization in any vascular bed, including coronary, cerebrovascular, or peripheral arteries, in the presence of ischemia or relevant end organ damage. And the major pre-specified subgroups were defined according to age checks and geographic regions. So, and then secondarily, they looked at this pre-specified hierarchical order. So then they did their pre-specified secondary, and they went down each composite or each component of the composite and tested them. And it, from my understanding, and I want to hear what your thoughts and what this means for you, is that one, they kept testing down the hierarchy until they found something that was not significant. And at that point, anything below that, even if they test it, we're not confident what that particular outcome that may become germane when we talk about the trial is that, what is that? Put that
That's
in
my,
your context or words or what your
yeah,
thoughts
that's
are.
my understanding is it's great. You know, the 2 primary endpoints, a 3-point MACE is phenomenal because it's very pure. A 4-point MACE is actually very respectful, but some people argue that it overemphasizes, it bloats up the results because it doubles the event rates because of that fourth
The
point.
procedural part, right? Yeah.
Yeah, the procedural part, it's still important, but if you want to be a purist, you know, it would be worse if you had only a 4-point MACE and people would ask, what's the 3-point MACE finding? So having the 3-point MACE as your leading outcome is really quite nice and quite eloquent from a study design. And the hierarchical is exactly, my understanding is exactly how you described it, is that you start going down serially, and once you lose statistical significance is when you say that anything there forward is probably hypothesis generating or a trend that
Right.
is noteworthy but not standalone.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other thing that was really interesting to me, and I definitely want to hear your thoughts on this and the thought and the design or what this is they also did a pre-specified assessment of the cholesterol trial treatment trialist collaboration endpoints of major coronary events, which was death due to acute myocardial infarction or non-myocardial infarction and major vascular events, which is, major coronary event stroke or coronary revascularization, which was limited to an ischemic data set and kind of looked at the change in baseline to LDL. And so just maybe, Joe, educate, why would they want to compare to our, if we think about lipid management, the cholesterol trial treatment trial, this is like the gold standard and where we actually get a lot of our thoughts of LDL lowering and thrush points. Is the goal there to just like really validate and say there's a lot of consistency here, so we should believe this? What are your thoughts on the reason to do that additional analysis?
I like that they did that. And if you're looking to look at it for yourself, yeah, I think you have to go to the appendix for it, but it is
Yeah.
there. And they presented it at the AHA meeting. I think it really is to confirm that the findings line up with LDL reduction. And it really excludes, I remember in the olden days, we used to think that statins were great because they had these pleiotropic effects that were beyond LDL lowering. But when everything line falls in the same regression line from the cholesterol treatment trialist collaboration, what it tells me as a clinician is that the benefit seen is really related to the LDL change. So it excludes any kind of magical effect that's from the drug that's LDL independent. That's sort of my take on it. I know whenever I say that, people always say, but some drugs do this, that, and other thing, and there's anti-inflammatory effects. And I don't know, at the end of the day, I think it's pointing mostly that it's all LDL. So it's very confirmatory that these findings are aligned with what you would expect with LDL lowering in our outcomes database.
Sure, very good. And then the interesting thing is this is an event-driven study for the 3-point MACE, and it was powered at a 90% to detect a 23% lower risk. And then the efficacy analysis was based on time to randomization, looking at it from that standpoint. So, as you said, Joe, I think this is the best way I can describe this trial design, and I'm gonna let you kind of speak to the outcomes and the data and so forth, but as you said, it's a very pure trial, especially with the 3-point MACE. Like it is, in my opinion, I don't know what your thoughts are. It is very clear cut. Like it is probably one of the cleanest trials I've seen in a while. Would you agree to that
I
statement?
agree completely. I mean, that's why I liked other trials in the past, like the heart protection study. And this one was when you have the courage and the confidence to do 3-point mace, it really tells you a lot. I mean, because some studies have beyond a 4-point mace, they add other things in there that really make it easier to see a difference. So it's pure. I think the only thing that people might criticize, they had a lot of, it wasn't one type of patient population, but I
Sure.
think that's more of a positive than it is a negative because we've already proven a lot. I mean, just think of the data that we have with Fourier and Odyssey. We know that PCSK9 inhibitors work well in just the clinical ASCVD population that has additional risk that they call very high risk. So this really answered a data gap in all the other patients, not whether statins work, whether LDL lowering works, but whether using a PCSK9 inhibitor on top of standard lipid lowering therapy. That's really where we're at if we want to achieve these lower LDL values, which based on the CTT analysis confer that lower is better. We used to think that LDL lowering was a hypothesis. It's no hypothesis. It's the relationship that lowering LDL does reduce risk in people with cardiovascular risk.
Very nice. All right, Joe. So I'm going to turn it over to you for a minute. Can you just go ahead and kind of tell us about it? So who did they end up getting into this trial? What is the population, and then kind of what did the results kind of tell us? And then we'll ask you some more follow-up questions.
Yeah, they looked at, I mean, as you already mentioned, they looked at people with coronary disease or cerebrovascular disease or PAD, except they eliminated people that had a history of an acute event. So think of those coronary patients that we see that maybe have chronic stable angina or that have had some kind of procedure but have never had the full-blown myocardial infarction. They included them in clinical where we treat them. And also people with TIAs, I guess, when you think of cerebrovascular disease, the primary prevention cohort was mostly our patients with diabetes, though some of them did have a history of event. But one thing that is in here that does jump out that a lot of people are gravitating to were the patients, and it was about 900 of them, that their form of coronary disease appeared to be that it was just a CAC score, a coronary artery calcium score of 100 or higher. And that is really interesting and intriguing. Because that's sort of when you hear the primary prevention, with subclinical atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, a lot of people will think about that population. I think there's a little hesitation to just to viewing this as a study that really is only about that because it's not, but it did have, I think it was about 900 plus patients that was their inclusion criteria, and their results patterned the overall results. There was no heterogeneity in their risk reduction in that population versus people from the total population. So I think it sheds light on not only the secondary prevention known patients, which were patients that have those clinical diseases. It shed some light on those asymptomatic subclinical ASCVD people that have just high CAC, and also your patients with diabetes. Now we have pretty clear data with the PCSK9 monoclonal antibodies that there's a reduction in cardiovascular events. And if you want to be a purist and just look at, where there is evidence when you use higher cost therapies such as PCSK9 monoclonal antibodies, we can now add that a proven population are our primary prevention diabetes patients that are higher risk. I think there's some inclusions that you mentioned that are important. It's not every patient with diabetes, it's your patient with additional cardiovascular risk.
Right. And so to your point, when I think about this, I guess I put them on a spectrum of where we're at, and clearly, as you said, this is not the event. Patients that haven't had a true event per se, they're at the tipping point, right? They're at the red light flashing, we need to do something kind of early on event. And then to your point, there's these little subgroups of sliver of like, this is very, very interesting, and these patients, maybe we can see what that is. And I don't know if you know the show, it, kind of to that population that you're alluding to, is there a long-term follow-up for those specific patients that they, I imagine they have some degree of assessment that they may be looking at, or do you know that? I
That's a
haven't
great
heard.
question, Craig. I don't know the exact answer to
Yeah.
that, but I would think that the answer is yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Great question, though.
So what else would you say about the characteristics or anything from the patient population? To me, when I look at the table one, they really didn't meet their inclusion criteria for the most part, and got truly some high risk patients. I think the big thing, and maybe you don't care about this, and I think it just would be an interesting analysis on the side, for me, just because I'm starting to do a lot of cardio-kidney metabolic things. And they clearly did truly just lipids and looked at lipid and lipid parameters. And obviously these patients have high risk. It would have been interesting to see how well they were managed in their other disease states. I was just curious myself personally. I'm not sure if they have that data, just as a context as a whole of like, what do these patients overall look like in terms of their other comorbid conditions that contribute to cardiac risk.
Yeah, I think that's important. I mean, because if you look at, over, I think it was 87% of the patients had hypertension. So you clearly want to know how tightly controlled they were. That data might be available in the appendix, though I haven't clearly looked at it.
It's not, and I've asked, and
Okay.
they may have it. They may have it's not in the appendix. They may have that data, but they have
Yeah.
not published that data. And
Got it.
so I was very curious about this because I'm like, well, that would be interesting to know, like, how well they are actually managed
And
from that
glycemic
demic.
control and
Yeah.
anti-platelet therapy might be in there too. But those are the kind of things that we think about, because
Sure.
what we've noticed over the years is that the event rates are, with these patients, when you look at a secondary prevention patient now in a study that's published in 2025 and compare it to one from 1990,
Right.
the placebo rates are a lot higher years ago because they didn't treat the residual risk as well. So
Sure.
those are things that I think, overall, I believe that these patients were mostly pretty well controlled for all their other comorbidities. I would like to see their blood pressure and see
Yeah,
their
well,
normal
I think
diabetes or
they have
A1C.
their meds in there, but they don't have the specific, like, here is
Yeah.
their where they're at starting out from that standpoint. So,
One
and I
thing
know
that
that's
isn't one thing
go
that
ahead,
is though
sorry.
important to note is that they had a good use of statin therapy in this population.
Oh,
So
yeah.
it was, 87% of patients were on statin therapies. That is important always to emphasize. And the
Sure.
majority were on high intensity. So they were, and even this was one of the highest utilizations of ezetimibe that I've seen in an outcome study. It was about 20%. So that one in five people were on ezetimibe, which is good. So
Yeah, and we'll
these,
come back to that as a question
okay.
at the end because I do have a question related to your thoughts on the ezetimibe piece, which is high. I'll give you that piece too, but just when you think about where to use this patient. So I want to hold that thought. But and then there was very few intolerant patients, if I recall correctly, it was like 8%. They don't have it listed specifically in the piece.
Yeah,
It wasn't very
I would
high.
infer like they
Yeah.
have. I think 8% were not on any lipid lowering regimen,
Right.
but 70. I'm actually looking at right now. 87% were on a statin, so 13 were not on a statin for whatever reason.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's jump right into the results. So let's talk about at least the lipid data first. So what did we see in terms of, kind of to your point, the LDL lowering and what does that look like with this? Is it consistent? Is it different? What did it look like, Joe?
When I look at this, the LDL lowering, in my opinion, is what you would expect for somebody who's on a monoclonal antibody against PCSK9. So what we would expect is that you should get 50 to 60% lowering in LDL cholesterol, and you can get that based off of what we see with these drugs just used and anybody else. But it went down. My look was that it went from a baseline of about 109 down to 45. Which is, looking at about 60% reduction in
Sure.
LDL cholesterol. It's what you would expect with patients that are adherent with therapy. So that's good. So it's
It's very
consistent.
consistent, right? It's consistent with the other data.
Yep,
Yeah.
absolutely.
Yeah. Which is so always good and encouraging to see. So, and now let's talk about the primary efficacy outcome. What did we see there with the 3-point MACE?
Yeah, the 3-point MACE was a 25. I mean, and we have some people, when you say relative risk reduction, people want to look at the number needed to treat. They want to go in this direction, that direction. A 25% relative risk reduction for a 3-point MACE is pretty good. The net result was 8% versus 6.2%. If you do a number need to treat, that actually is also pretty favorable. Also, we're looking at, I think it's about about 30 or so is what I'm ballparking it as. So this is a respectable reduction that is meaningful, and it's
Right.
what you would expect when you, in contrast to like other studies, you just think about, and I don't want to go too much on a tangent, but we look a lot at the ezetimibe data. It made the event rates go from 35% to 33% after 7 years. And now we're
Right.
looking at stuff that goes from 8 to 6.2%. Those endpoints aren't exactly the same, but you can get mired in the details because that difference was 2%. But the
Right.
net difference isn't as important. I think it's the relative risk reduction and looking at what the baseline risk. So all of this, for a reasonable time frame of less than 5 years, is actually very good.
Yeah, no, I think that is great. And then kind of when you do this hierarchical testing, what is interesting is you see obviously from a combined
standpoint, when you look at the combined MACE and go down that, you still see this reduction. And what was really compelling to see, as a specific event, is that also myocardial infarction and, of course, ischemic driven EV, they were above the threshold. It's as you get lower, and unfortunately, like you see when you get to some of the death related pieces. And A, maybe it wasn't following, but when you get to the higher go stop testing, because there was a point that it became not significant, from my understanding. And so you can't infer anything about the death outcomes, but you definitely see that this myocardial infarction was reduced as well, from that standpoint, which in theory you would think by extrapolation, if you're preventing events and or even ischemic driven events that has complications, that you would hopefully or maybe see some reduction in mortality at that point. But yeah,
Yeah,
again,
and
you're
it might
just
just
making
take
a
a little bit
difference.
longer. When you have well-treated patients, it may take a little longer, and it was in the right direction. It's just because of the hierarchical testing. I think you can't say that with confidence.
No, you can't say it with confidence, but it was interesting. The MI, you definitely can say, even though it's a secondary, it's pre-specified,
I was
you can
thinking more the
definitely
death, yeah.
say, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, the death,
I was
for
thinking
sure.
death, yeah. MI, I think we can say with confidence.
And so it really does, to me, again, very clean trial, very clean in terms of outcomes. You know, it's very straightforward and who the benefits were, and of course those benefits are pretty consistent. Like if you look at the confidence intervals, and you're averaging around that 25% across the board, for no matter how you slice it, for the most part. I mean, it's give or take a little bit, but it's like it's pretty consistent for the most part. Actually, I think the MI is the one that's a little bit more dramatic in terms of the
It
percent,
is. It
relative
was like
risk reduction
36% relative risk
from that
reduction for
standpoint.
MI. Yeah,
Right,
that's a
right.
lot.
And yeah, that's a lot. So, and then tell me about what they kind of said. I know it's in the appendix, but they alluded to it. It is essentially, it falls right in line with the cholesterol treatment trials collaboration, right? Like
It
everything that
does.
you see, if I recall the graph, it fits almost, maybe not directly square in the middle, but it's pretty close.
Yeah,
So,
it's funny because I when it was presented, I took a picture of it because it was simultaneously published, and so I didn't have the appendix to look at but it is one of those slides when it was up there. I'm like, I need to capture this, so I captured it. And for major coronary events, it was slightly above the line, which is good because I mean it's close enough to the line. And then when they looked at major vascular events, just collectively, it was a little bit below the line, but it was so close to the line that it's about the same. That's my conclusion.
So very, very consistent. And then, of course, from a safety standpoint, we see no major increase events, very similar to the other PCSK9 studies in terms of injection site reactions and other things to that effect.
Absolutely.
So I guess, Joe, and I can't, now that I know you're on the new set of guidelines, I can't really ask you this question, but maybe I can opine what I think the case is. I'm thrilled that this data has come out at the time, and I don't know, you may not be able to answer this question. I don't know if you guys have, quote unquote, locked the guidelines at this particular time. Don't answer that if you can't. But does it, to me, it gives just maybe some further emphasis of really doing this continual risk reduction that we need to see in our patient population. And I guess the way I look at it is, it really is a reminder or a call to arms that we shouldn't just wait on these people. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is, I don't think inherently it changes my opinion about who the patients are that need to be treated or where they might fall in terms of their, clearly these are high risk patients. But I think what it does give to me, and I don't know how you would frame this in the guidelines, so please don't, and I know you can't answer this, but it speaks to the urgency of not delaying treatment. And I think that that's the bigger message that I think about this. I don't know what your thoughts are, independent of a guideline writer. And if you're able to separate yourself from the two and give an opinion, what would your thought be?
Well, it's funny. We just got an alert yesterday from leadership not to, to remain our to not say anything because we're embargoed.
Sure,
I would
absolutely.
direct people though to the the timeline that's posted on the AHA and ACC web pages. What I will say though, even I think guidelines are great because guidelines interpret data, but clinicians always, we're always going to be in a situation where we get data that's beyond guidelines. Whether it's, I don't know, maybe it'll be this one, maybe it won't be this one, or but it will be future ones, and that we have to bridge that in. So when you look just holistically at Vesalius, it gives us very high confidence in using PCSK9 monoclonal antibodies or PCSK9 drugs that block circulating PCSK9, because that's what the monoclonal antibodies do, that there's event reduction associated with them. And it's and if you really believe the CTT analysis, it's because LDL is lower. So it
Sure.
does, and it just extends the population where we have more robust event data when we're looking at the second or third drug. It's clearly the second drug for most people, but it's the third for those people that were also on a statin with ezetimibe.
Yeah, and going back to the ezetimibe, of course, people can look at, if you pull the data or have access to it, you can definitely pull the forest plots and see, clearly the people who didn't have ezetimibe also benefit dramatically, and there doesn't seem to be heterogeneity if you're on it. What? So let me ask it in this way: if you're in clinic, are you, and this patient comes to clinic for you, are you still always putting ezetimibe on for? And let's not talk about patients that were truly secondary prevention. Like, this is secondary prevention. I know we just had that debate. Let me say it this way: patients that have had an event, a patient comes to you that hasn't had an event, are you still doing the three of them, high statin if you can, ezetimibe and PCSK9? Are you using the PCSK9 first? Or just because, again, they only had 20% of them on ezetimibe in the study, and you kind of see the results are pretty significant. I guess, I don't, if you're able to answer that question,
Yeah, I
what
mean
are you, how are you thinking about
it's a
that?
very clinically relevant question. I'm always going to be statin first, and I'm always going to try the maximum tolerated dose, whatever that is for your individual patient. And I'm the kind of clinician that in the past I had always done ezetimibe first because of just the prior authorization requirements for a PCSK9 inhibitor.
The
But
gauntlet
if
of prior
that,
authorization? Yes,
yeah, I mean, it's, but I
right.
tell you, I in reality, if a patient's really close to goal, whatever my goal is or my target LDL, whatever we want to call it, if they're really close, then I'm going to use ezetimibe because to be cost conscious. If they're far
Sure.
from their goal and if they need a 20% or more reduction, I really want that PCSK9 drug. And if their prior authorization does not require ezetimibe, I'm not always doing it. So I will do it if they're close, and I'll do it if it's required to get access to my patient. But I'm not. I've encountered a lot of prior authorizations that don't always recommend or require that ezetimibe stepped care.
Require. Yep. Can I ask this question? And again, it may be not, if you can't answer because of guidelines, I totally appreciate that. But, or if you don't even want to share your personal opinion, I will tell you, me personally, I've become more of a, I treat patients to as low as I possibly can get them, depending on what they can tolerate. Is that kind of your philosophy at this particular juncture? Because, and this will come up, and maybe we hold this thought because it'll be very germane in the next study for some of the way that they had to do their analyses with the study. But it's an interesting thought to that same point. And then, secondarily, a lot of people are thinking about overall, which this would not fully be germane to this study, but just over lifetime risk and exposure of elevated LDLs and so forth. Expand. Well, we can talk about that in a minute. So maybe I'll hold off on that question until we get to the next set of data. Is there anything else you would add to this trial, Joe?
I have nothing else.
Okay.
No,
Nothing
yeah.
else to add. Very good.
Nope.
All right. Very good. It was a very clean trial. So, all right, Joe. So let's transition to the next study. And I have lots of questions for you on this, or I can tell you my opinions, but I just want to hear your opinions too. So this is the efficacy and safety of enclisetide. It's an oral PCSK9 inhibitor for lowering LDL cholesterol in adults with at risk for ASCVD. So this is the CORALreef-Lipid study. The trial has not been published yet at this time, but
we do have a lot of the data that was presented. And so, obviously we just outlined why PCSK9s are important, and of course looking at injectable PCSK9 inhibitors and obviously the ability to do them. We have PCSK9s that we give every 2 weeks. We have the kind of inclisiran-based therapy that is a little bit more less frequently, excuse me, from that standpoint. And what we'll talk about this, they all appeal to be very consistent. And so I'll say the trial design, and then Joe, we can kind of contrast maybe the patient populations that were in the study compared to this, the other study, what this, what you take away from this. But in this study, they had patients that had a history of major atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or and had an event. So these patients with an ASCVD event and an LDL cholesterol over 55, equal or greater than 55 milligrams per deciliter, or they could also be enrolled if they were at risk, kind of like the population for a major first ASCVD event and had an LDL greater than equal to 70 milligrams for milligrams per deciliter. And patients had to be optimized and stable on background lipid-lowering therapy with moderate or high-intensity statin or an intolerance or other lipid-lowering therapies with no change. And then so they were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to Enlicitide 20 milligrams daily from that standpoint or placebo on background therapy. And it was followed up for, it's a 52-week trial and an 8-week study. And so they had a follow-up or an open label extension arm. And patients were excluded if they had an ASCVD event in the past 3 months. So nobody in the acute phase, active or recent treatment with a PCSK9 inhibitor, uncontrolled diabetes, or triglycerides greater than 400 milligrams per deciliter at screening. And then their primary endpoint was a mean percent change in LDL cholesterol from baseline at week 24, and percentage of patients with adverse events, and percentage of patients with discontinuation due to adverse events. And then the secondary endpoints were, and it was multiplicity controlled, mean percent change from baseline at LDL the whole trial duration, week 52, and mean percent change in baseline at week 24 in terms of non-HDL-C and ApoB, and then change. Percent change from baseline in Lp(a) at week 24. And then other secondary endpoints that were not multiplicity controlled were the portion of patients, and I think this one's a very interesting, those with a greater than 50% reduction or equal to 50% reduction in LDL cholesterol and had an LDL less than 70, and then greater than equal to 50% reduction in LDL cholesterol and an LDL cholesterol less than 55 milligrams per deciliter. And so that was kind of the trial design. So Joe, if you had to think about this trial differently, and of course it's a different trial and different outcomes, but just in terms of the type of patients we're enrolling in, what would you say it's similar or different to what we just talked about with the last trial?
It is different. This is a regulatory study. So it's a phase
Sure.
three trial that's designed to get the efficacy and safety data for this drug in the population that you would use it in real practice. So they picked people that were basically above their LDL threshold target goal, whatever we want to call it, that would need additional therapy. So that was sort of their basic conclusion. I think that's why they had the, 55 or higher or 70 or higher, depending on the patient population. And those are really the numbers that come from the 2022 ACC expert consensus decision pathway on what LDL to achieve. So they looked at people who would just need
Sure.
additional lipid-lowering therapy. And nothing jumps out as abnormal. Enlicitide decanoate is proven in phase two trials to lower LDL cholesterol. So the purpose of phase three is in a bigger population, which is exactly what this did. The 2-to-1 ratio is no surprise because that's what you do in a lot of phase three trials. And the key exclusions are not anything out of the ordinary. They just excluded populations that may have changes in LDL cholesterol or weird to evaluate LDL cholesterol for another reason, such as the triglycerides being very high or a
Sure.
recent event or recent use of another PCSK9 inhibitor.
Yeah, so this trial, to your point, the goal of this is eventually the, and I think the plan after this data is released is to submit it for regulatory approval, right? To be able to have this agent on the market. But it is still interesting to look at it from that standpoint. Very good. All right. So what was interesting about this study, and I want to draw attention to this, and we can talk about it both as they enrolled patients into it and a little bit about the magic that they had to do in this study. But if you look at reasons for study discontinuation, as we get into, they screened about 4,150 patients, and they had about
about 2,912 enrolled into the study, and it was an intent to treat population that was, in there, and they had about 94.6 in the treatment group and 94.7 in the placebo group actually complete the full study. When you look at the reasons for discontinuation for study, this is study discontinuation. You had about 5.6 in the treatment group and 5.3 in the placebo group, and the vast majority of reasons for people to stop the study as a whole were the subjects withdraw themselves from that standpoint. So it wasn't necessarily a physician decision. It wasn't a loss to follow-up. It wasn't death. It wasn't, adverse events. That was the case from that standpoint. But then when you look at, people that actually completed treatment, like not just completed the study, but actually completed all their phases of treatment, and this is a little different group of population, it was 11.6% stop treatment in both group, or in the treatment group, 11.1 that stopped it. What was actually interesting, and this is different, is about 3.4% in the treatment arm, it was the participant decision, 3.3% were withdrawn by a subject, and then 3.2 kind of related to adverse events. And this was higher than the placebo group. It was like 2.3, 2.4, and 4 for adverse events from that standpoint. So there were, interestingly, a decent amount of people that kind of withdrew for the treatment at some point. And from my understanding, and we'll get into a little bit of some of this analysis, there were some concerns about the lowering of their cholesterol that got people concerned about being in the study. I don't know if you got to hear that explanation during the presentation.
Yeah, I heard a little bit of that, and I sort of left it with left thinking it's a small percent, it's a small difference, and it really wasn't.
Sure.
Maybe that answer might change a little bit. I don't know. I got that impression that it wasn't with the highest level of confidence.
Yeah, no. Correct, absolutely. And then if you look at the population, it was a 40% about of females that were in the study, 39%. And then you look at the age, it was very similar age, about 62.8 average age, mostly a good geographic region mix, not necessarily concentrated in one area or the other, which is a little bit different than the last study where it was maybe really concentrated in Europe across the board. And then about 60% of the people had a history of a major ASCVD event. 9% had heterozygous familial hypercholesterolemia, and 50% had about 49% had type 2 diabetes. So, kind of to your point, already a very high risk patient population, correct?
And I think there's some good diversity in this population. So it's a good number of women. It's not
Yeah,
50-50,
absolutely.
but it's better than a lot of other studies. And I think they could have done maybe a little bit better in some of our Black or African American patients, but at least it's not a strong majority of white patients. It was in the 50% that were white. And not it's really
Sure.
hard, depending on where you do these studies, to get a very great mix of races, but I think it's sometimes we hear of, 90% white, mostly men, and that's not the study, so that's good.
Sure. Yeah. And then, a good, like the last trial, a lot of patients on moderate or high intensity statin therapy, and a number of them, like we just talked about, on ezetimibe as well. And then, interesting enough, the LDL mean was very similar to the last one, 96.1 for an average, and then non-HDL 122. And then, of course, they added or had these parameters with ApoB and Lp(a), and 91.2 and 38.9. Just, I don't want to go on a complete diatribe about these two because that's going to be for another day. But just in your context, Joe, what do those two parameters mean for this patient population?
The LDL being the LDL is just about 100. That's why when I look at that,
Yeah.
and it's far from 55, and
Sure.
it's relatively far from 70. So this is the kind of patient, when I look at it, is adding ezetimibe going to get it done? Based on the average, to my answer is no. So this is the kind of patient where I'm more likely to want to go to a stronger drug like a PCSK9, and
Sure.
this is an oral PCSK9 inhibitor that. We will see the results to see if it's
Yep.
comparable to what we know with the monoclonals.
Yep. Very good. And what about the Lp(a) and ApoB? Anything
Yeah,
you want to
I mean
connect with?
the ApoB is great to see because it sort of is a more refined way of looking at atherogenic lipoproteins. We use LDL cholesterol, but every LDL is attached to an ApoB, so it is the more pure way of looking at it, especially when you have a insulin resistant or metabolic kind of patient. And when you get people, when you start getting into the double digits of LDLs, ApoB and LDL is usually close to one another, especially when you get towards 70. The actual numbers get very close, but it's good to see just to look at all like atherogenic lipoproteins. And the LPA is, gonna be a very evolving thing right now. We know Lp(a) or LPA, whichever one you want to call it, is atherogenic. It's an inherited thing. One in five people have elevated lipoprotein A. These patients did not. That unit is nanomoles per liter. So those
Sure.
are, on average, normal LPA values. But we do know that PCSK9 inhibitors are probably the strongest available drugs we have in the market right now that are contemporary for lipid lowering at lowering Lp(a). And it's 20 to 30%. So it's not like, a huge reduction, but it's a nice to know.
Sure. No, it's good. And I want you to contextualize that. You said exactly what I want you to say. So it's good. So here's we're gonna start. So if you look at the primary endpoint, it's an LDL reduction at week 24, and so they see about between the two groups an average of 55.8, and so the placebo group had about a 3+ positive, and then the treatment group had a negative 57.1% at 24 weeks of treatment, and that's missing data handled by the study group. But then you look at week 52, you see about a positive 4% change over the 52 weeks, and then it's negative 50.4% for treatment. So about a change overall of negative 47.6. What's interesting, and I want to hear with the statistical analysis plan. So what was interesting is they had some uniqueness about kind of these BQ values or values that were less than zero, and how they would handle those and setting them at one. So kind of what did you take away from this in the middle of the conversation about what's going on with the handling of this
Sure.
beta quadrant data, and what does that mean for, in case people don't know, what did they do here? What does this mean from
Beta
that standpoint?
quantiferon. Yeah, I mean, like, so why they designed, my understanding is that they decided before a priori to actually measure LDL cholesterol using beta quantification, which is ultracentrifugation. So the gold standard for measuring LDL cholesterol, not what people do in clinical practice, by the way. But they had patients that had these had zero values and based on the beta quant, which was surprising. There wasn't many of them, but it resulted in, actually, I think it was five patients having a 4,000% increase in their LDL on treatment, which is just unfathomable, right? You're not gonna, that's just outrageous. So they pr Donald Lloyd Jones said this the best, because he at AHA did the critique. And if you ever have an on-demand ability to listen to him, he's wonderful way of interpreting this. He said they got too cute, and that maybe like too crafty. Nobody in other trials, to my recollection, has ever done this. So sometimes when you use methods that aren't done in clinical practice that are like ivory tower, we see zebras and we see things that don't make sense. And I think that's probably what this is. It's in my understanding, it was five patients. So it really probably just created a little bit more. It took up 1 or 2 minutes of a 10-minute presentation that probably didn't need to be there. But
Sure.
it
Well,
but
and
but
go
there is
ahead. Go
one
ahead.
trend. I mean, one thing that you mentioned that was interesting to me is that there was a little bit of a regression in the efficacy when you looked at week 24 versus 52 based on the data you presented. And this happens sometimes in other studies. It happened with bempedoic acid and the CLEAR Outcomes to some extent when it went up. I was interested by this. And at AHA, they presented, not to get off track, there's a coral reef heterozygous FH study that was presented that actually is published in JAMA simultaneously. They didn't really see this regression. So I think it's not as impressive as it may look numerically, because it wasn't replicated, at least in the heterozygous population. And maybe this is related somewhat to the little bit of a difference in the dropouts, that you went over earlier.
Yeah, and what was interesting, as you said, their other lipid parameters didn't match this whole thing either, and so that was where they're like, there's something on. So they ended up screening those patients out as the long of the story. And when you did that, you see that the inclisiran was actually 59.6, and so it was a change of 59.7 for a mean difference. And then for the 52 weeks, it was, and that was for the 24 weeks, but for the 52 weeks, it was 52.4. And then what you'd see is across the board for non-HDL-ApoB and Lp(a), you see this like 53.4 for non-LDL or HDL cholesterol. ApoB was about a 50.3, and Lp(a) or Lp(a) negative 28.2. And most people end up meeting their goals. And it sounded like what I gathered from this is everybody tolerated the therapy very well. Here's the question I want to ask you. So here's the study adherence thing. And I want to talk to you about this, Joe, from a real world perspective. So the unique thing about this therapy, what is the unique thing about how you have to take this therapy? Do you want to explain to the
You know,
audience?
this is my understanding because it is it's a like a peptide, and my understanding, though I want to see this in the final publication on exactly how I instructed patients, is that it is intended to be on an empty stomach
Correct.
with a
2 hours
volume of water.
delay, right? You have to wait
Yeah.
2 hours before and after to take
Yeah, and you know we and that's probably that's something that people bring up. It is
it.
something we have to do with other drugs, like levothyroxine. I mean, I
Sure.
thought almost like a levothyroxine or like a bisphosphonate kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that might have, maybe that's the reason why there was a small difference in dropouts. Not really that noteworthy, but it is something that needs to be managed. And it's something that to some patients might be challenging.
Yeah, well, and I asked the question, and it's about 97% followed the fasting instructions,
It's really
and
good.
played it. So it was very high. And I'm like, well, that's
Very
impressive.
high. I wasn't expecting to be that high.
I don't see that happening in the real world, but we'll see. And I said, well, I actually was curious. I'm like, well, if they waited an hour, what does it look like? You know what I mean? Like, I'm
Well, and I
curious
heard
that.
people, Craig, people said that maybe that's why there was a little bit of a loss in the effect going on 52 weeks because people got a little bit less diligent with doing that, which makes sense.
It does, and it gives food for thought as someone who deals with patients and pharmacy and all the things from that standpoint. And then when you look at adverse systems, offense by or treatment by organs, you had infection. They're very balanced. It wasn't there was one more than another appeared to be safe from that standpoint. What was interesting too, and we already talked about this, and what it tells me more so is, and Joe, I'd love to hear your thoughts about this, is the reductions compared to inclisiran, and they compared it to alirocumab and evolocumab and inclisiran. They are like so consistent, right? Like it is
They
like
are.
we have found something that is almost as consistent, and I joke about this as SGLT2s are consistent in terms of their reductions. But I mean, it is, you can peg those numbers almost as good as statin numbers, right?
You can.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely.
So,
I mean, and that there's good in that because consistency also implies that that correctness, that that's actually what it is.
yeah, very good. So here's my question to you that we kind of started alluding to in the other kind of study is like, okay, when are you reaching for an agent like this versus a subcutaneous agent, or who maybe your clinic experience is different than my clinic experience. And so I want to ask this, like, do you have people you're like, they need to be on an oral agent, or do you get what I'm saying? Like, I guess
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand, and maybe it's a cost thing. Who knows what this cost will be comparatively or what that looks like. And maybe that's the difference, is the access will be easier. What are your hypotheses of where this is going to fall?
I think there's a lot of patients where they don't care if it's an injectable or an oral. I see that. But I also see patients that they prefer oral and they prefer not to have an injection for whatever reason. My sister-in-law is one of those people where she
Yeah.
won't even, you know, she won't use an injectable medication at all, even though she might benefit from one of them. So
Sure.
I think that's an issue. And I think another end to this is production. And
Yeah.
this may relate to cost. I mean, monoclonal antibodies are not the easiest drugs to make. They're not small molecules or large molecules. Monoclonal antibodies have a more refined production pathway. Oral agents are more streamlined and more mass produced in an easier manner. And that's always going to probably relate to a difference in cost and a difference in availability. So I think if you ask 10 people, it's just my opinion, if you ask 10 people, would they rather have an oral medicine or an injection? I'd say that more than five, the majority would prefer a pill, prefer oral versus versus an injection, but we'll just probably have to see.
Yeah. So I guess my question to you, Joe, going back to all these, and we think about the ezetimibe, and I guess I would like to data I would like to see, and I don't know what your thoughts are. I would like to see the high intensity statin ezetimibe in either one of these agents treatment groups and understand and see if it's comparative to what we've seen in other data. Because I guess my going back to what we were about to talk about in the last study is, is there in your mind, is there a too low? Maybe I'll ask you that directly. Is I personally have like I said, I just continue to lower as best as I can. I don't feel like there's a concern for me for going too low. What are your thoughts?
I'm not afraid of going too low. I just don't know if it's always needed in all people.
Sure.
For very high risk patients, I think getting low values in some guidelines in other countries go recommend less than 40 or sometimes even less than 30 for your highest risk patient
Sure.
population. And if you look at just the data that we have available with PCSK9s from FOURIER, there half the patients were less than 30 and there wasn't safety signals. So from a
Sure.
safety perspective, I'm not afraid, but the reality is not everybody needs to have it be that
Oh,
low.
absolutely. I would
I
agree with you
will,
on
but
that.
I'm a lower is better in our secondary prevention patients. I am, but for maybe my primary prevention diabetes patient, even if they have additional risk factors, I don't think they need an LDL of 30.
Right.
I'm happy if it's less than 70, and if it's less than 55, that's great too.
Sure. So let me ask you this then, and just to let the audience know. What is the next step in the future? Are people going to do primary prevention studies with PCSK9 inhibitors? Is that where we're going next?
You
Makes
know,
sense.
that's a good question. All the PCSK9 inhibitors that we have, like enlicitide, they have an outcome study. They're looking at higher risk people. There's AZD0780 that just got a name, which is Larovstat, a different kind of name that is an oral PCSK9 inhibitor, works in the hepatocyte. There's also, and they have an outcome study and they're looking at high risk people. So it seems as though the studies that are looking at LDL lowering are still picking the higher risk patients, but after they do that, they may
Sure.
evolve to get to more of the primary prevention population. It's, I have mixed feelings because when we do those big outcome studies, it's always great to have data, but it does, it adds cost to somebody and it gets passed somewhere along
Sure.
the line. So somebody's got to pay for those large studies, which are millions and millions of dollars. But I don't know the answer to that. There's
Sure.
even a there's even a, another
Well, and I guess
PCSK9 drug coming out.
Yeah, well, and I think, what I gather is people are starting to look at not just these lowering, but like what is the lifetime residual risk, or do we, from an exposure or duration of exposure? Because realistically, when you look at all these kind of secondary prevention studies or these types of studies, these patients are somewhat older. Like, they're not in their 30s or 40s or, patients that have some, degree of could we do real good and prevent things,
You
before
bring up
they
a good
happen
point
or
though,
whatever that be.
Craig.
I think that's
Like,
always the question. I think I'm curious.
if you think of the lifetime hypothesis that Brian Ferentz has published on, it's sort of like the pack years is to smoking, LDL is to, risk of ASCVD.
Sure.
If you get somebody early and just give them some lowering for their lifetime, you probably don't need to get as low because your area under the curve might not be as much.
Sure.
But if somebody's been untreated for a period of time and they're elderly, they're probably the ones that it's extremely important to get them down just to get their burden. They've been laying down plaque their whole life. So I guess if you catch
Sure,
somebody earlier,
absolutely.
you don't maybe they don't have to
Yeah.
go as low. But if you get somebody late, maybe there is, I'm
It
guessing
was
based on just
aggressive.
that. Yeah,
Yeah.
be more aggressive.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it'll be interesting to see as it develops or if people continue to go around that process.
Yeah.
All right, this has been great. I really appreciate your time and effort. And then as always, and I kind of gave you a heads up, we always ask non-clinical questions to let people know that we are not completely just consumed by pharmacy
Sure.
all of our times. And you're getting a new one that I've never asked before. So I'll hold on to that in a minute because I'm just like, oh, it's something that no one's ever asked other people. But the first one is any good books, movies, podcast, anything that you're currently into that you would recommend to people that is not pharmacy related?
I do like TV shows. And so there's two that I'm in the middle of right now that I really like. One's The Morning Show, which I think is got great acting. So I like that storyline. And another one is Friends and Neighbors, which is Jon Hamm in it, and it's also got good acting and just sort of an interesting storyline. So those are two of the things that I
Interesting.
like
I'll have
right
to
now.
pick one
There's
up. I've not heard
a
about. I've heard about The Morning Show, but I've not heard this one.
Yeah, Friends and Neighbors. I think it's only on Apple TV. And there's a book that I have on my list that I haven't bought yet. It's From Strength to Strength that was recommended to me. That's on my list to read.
Okay. Very good. We kind of cut out there for a minute,
Oh,
so we'll
do you
have
want me to
to
say that last
dive.
part
What was that
again?
last? Yeah, the
There,
last part again. Yeah.
there's a book on my list that I haven't read yet, and I have to buy it, but it's called From Strength to Strength.
Okay. I'll have to look that one up too. From strength to strength. Very good. Okay, and Joe, this is like the off the wall question that I just added. You're the first to get this because I'm just like thinking about questions that people have never asked anybody before. Or so if you've watched a lot of TV, is there any opening credits based on song or and or design that really stick out to your mind? Like I think about that regularly, or it was so impactful or interesting. It's just such a random niche question, but do you have a show that you're like, those opening credits were amazing?
Yeah, it's got to be Game of Thrones, because of both the music
Yeah.
and the visuals, but and because I really like that. I
Yeah.
like the whole series except for the last one,
That
last
show.
season.
Yeah. Very good. Well, I'm not going to answer mine yet because I'm going to get a collection of these and then let people hear because these are the, I guess I have a weird quirk of these are the things that I think about regularly. Not regularly, but I cross my mind. I'm like, that was a really neat sequence or something to that effect. But, anyways, Joe, if people wanted to find you, where could they find you?
I'm on LinkedIn, so at that or my school's website. So you can, if you Google my name, you'll find that I work at the University of Colorado and what my email is. But I do ha have my professional Facebook, I guess, is LinkedIn.
Sure. No, very good. Always amazing to catch up with you, Joe, at anything, whether it be here or meetings or whatever. I always enjoy talking to you and learning from you and all the things. So that I really appreciate you taking the time.
And I
So,
appreciate the opportunity, and I always enjoy talking with you too, Craig.
yeah.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. Yep. All right, team, if you like this content, again, like or subscribe. We will come back in 2 weeks when we will talk about more stuff from the AHA. I have a couple of different things on deck. I know there is a lot of lipid content. We will probably not do lipids next time. We will alter it and do something else and then come back to the other lipid content because this to me felt like a very lipid heavy meeting, right, Joe? It was
It
like
was very lipid heavy, yes.
I was like, we're gonna have to break it up a little bit, break up the monotony.
Triglycerides, yes.
Yeah, like all
Genetic
the
therapy.
things, genetic therapy, which I do, like I have lots of commentary, but we're gonna to do a different topic in 2 weeks, likely related to some other disease state domains. But I appreciate your time, Joe. And again, like or subscribe, let us know. Thank you so much.